duties, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Higher Side Chats.
Hallelujah, Higher Side Chatters. How the hell are you? Drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke, just trying to get into that magical state of mind. Today is an amazing show. Phil is a great guest and even walks us through evoking an entity. So pay attention there and we can evoke tens of thousands of entities across the world if you concentrate and do the exercise along with Phil. I also wanted to let you people know that I will be at the Secret Space Program Conference in San Mateo, California on June 28th and 29th. If you want to get weird and hear about breakaway civilizations and secret black ops technologies, it's going to be a trip that I would recommend making. Also, this round of the Money Bomb is higher than ever thanks to a ton of added input and people signing up for the monthly donations, which is great, and one very generous donation of $1,000. We are at the point where the winner gets at least $700, so consider that. And if you're not sure how it works, here's the quick rundown. And we're going to be talking magic, entities, evocation, invocation, NLP, and the goddamn kitchen sink with Philip Farber on the other side. Hey people, I gotta take a second to tell you about something we do around here called the THC Money Bomb. What I do is every 5 episodes, I total up the donations I've gotten in that period of time, and half keeps me and the show going. I take the other half and I gift that back to a random listener. So far we're hitting about 500 each round and I couldn't be happier about it. So consider throwing in 5 or 10 bucks. It's cheaper than a hand at the blackjack table with better odds than a scratch-off ticket. Plus, you know half supports a show you like, and at the very least, half will go to a like-minded person who could probably use a nice surprise in these troubled times. When you make a donation, I can see your email address, and that's how I pick the winner. But to keep things kosher, you can also get in the pool by sending your info on a postcard to me, Greg Carlwood, P.O. Box 635223, San Diego, California, 92163. Dollars, bitcoins, it's all good to me. And that's what we call the THC Money Bomb. Boom. All right, folks, as we try to get a proper grip on this reality in which we find ourselves, it's always fun to hear from the people who seem to have a deeper understanding of this thing called life. Well, the particular flavor of universal insight that I find to be the tastiest lately is that of the magician. With an arsenal of practices like evocation, sigil making, and banishing rituals, a curious mind can't help but wonder how these things work and just how powerful a magician's toolbox can be. Well, today's guest, Philip Farber, is just the guy to give us that look under the hood. Phil is not only a well-respected and longtime magic practitioner, he's also extended his skill set to include being a certified hypnotist, hypnotist instructor, and expert trainer in the field of neuro-linguistic programming, or better known as NLP. He's written 3 highly acclaimed books in the field of magic entitled Future Ritual, Magic for the 21st Century, Meta Magic, the Book of Atem, Achieving New States of Consciousness through NLP Neuroscience and Ritual, and the nugget of magical wisdom I was lucky enough to read myself, Brain Magic, Exercises in Meta Magic and Invocation. It's going to be a wild ride, and I, for one, cannot wait. Philip, my man, welcome to THC.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Yeah, man. I mean, I'm psyched to have you here. It's a real honor. I learned about your work from a listener request, and I have a ton of respect for anyone who's taken the time to master the mind to the level that you have, when I can't even seem to get through 5 minutes of meditation before I'm wondering what's going to happen on the next Game of Thrones. You know what I mean?
Well, that is actually part of the process of meditation. I mean, most people think that, you know, when you sit down to meditate, you know, magically your mind is going to be clear and you're focused and whatever, but really the process, and in yogic terms, the term is dharana, which is a fluctuation between concentration and distraction. And it's actually something that some important lessons that we learn about our mind from doing that in terms of what we tend to distract ourselves with and how to quiet that part of the brain down and so on. It takes a while.
Right on. Well, that's a little comforting because I consider myself to be a mess, frankly. But I do find it interesting that you blend magic with NLP, and I think that's as good a place as any to start this thing because almost everyone I've spoken with about magic seems to have a unique style to it. So tell us a little bit about your approach to magic and how you found it complementary to something like NLP.
Well, I started out with very traditional approaches to magic, with Golden Dawn type magic and Aleister Crowley's Thelemic magic, which is all pretty traditional kind of ritual, you know, very formal ritual kind of work. And I was lucky enough very early on in my career as a magician to come into contact with some folks who were part of an unbroken lineage from Crowley and other older magicians, and were doing it right, let's just say. They were doing some ritual that was very powerful, and I got that experience right away. Around the same time that I was coming in contact with these folks, I was also getting involved in NLP. Well, I've been involved in hypnosis since I was a kid. That's another story entirely. But I was getting involved in NLP. And part of NLP, really the core of NLP, is the process of modeling, of being able to observe some kind of behavior and understand how it works and break it down into the small chunks of behavior that make it possible to understand it and learn it a little bit more easily. Normally in the field of NLP, people use that to break down the processes of, you know, great business thinkers and decision makers and people who've overcome their habits and public speakers and things like that. In my case, I was coming in contact with some of these great magicians, and the first thing that popped into my head at that point, because I had all this NLP going on in my head, was, wow, I can use this to model the magicians. You know, what is it that makes this ritual work? What is it that's giving me the goosebumps running up and down my spine when they do this ritual? And, it took some years to do it. And I actually got quite a bit of resistance from the actual magic people at that time, because NLP was kind of unknown and kind of a rarity. NLP was pretty new. We're talking the early 80s. But over the years, I was able to do enough of this, and there's certainly a vast amount of magic technique and practice and so on that I've yet to study and so on. But at least the little corner that I've been involved in, I've been able to model it enough that I've learned some interesting things doing it.
Yeah, man, witnessing a powerful ritual, that is exactly what I've been waiting for before my mind is really willing to do all the work. Because it seems like taking someone who's never heard of science and then putting them in front of neurology, you know, space exploration, chemistry, everything. It seems like a daunting field of study that, I don't know, I dabble in it from an outsider's perspective, but I'm dying to witness a really powerful ritual that validates the experience for me. And that seems to be kind of the catch-22, is that it usually doesn't happen that way for a lot of people. So you're kind of lucky in that sense.
Yeah, I think early on in my contact, there were enough weird and unusual things that happened in the context of ritual that I became very intrigued. Odd synchronicities and so on. It became pretty convincing to me right away. And of course, most people have this idea of magical ritual that it's exclusively this idea of paranormal or supernatural or something like that. And it certainly includes that. But as far as I'm concerned, there's really no demarcation between what we consider normal behavior, I mean, natural behavior, and what most people lump into paranormal. I think there's a continuum, and by learning how to do some of the more mundane things with our brains, some of this other stuff starts to happen as well. So usually when I start people off with magic, there are more things that we would think of more, I don't know, psychological or therapeutic or something like that. Things about getting your life together and habit change and developing confidence and beliefs and so on. Ultimately, a lot of the so-called paranormal stuff comes down to that. Think of magic as a way to manage and create a hierarchy for your beliefs, so that by opening yourself up to beliefs that include possibility and miracles and unusual things, we start to notice these things happening around us a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. One thing that gets confusing to me, and I think it is an issue that a lot of curious minds have, and you've kind of touched on that, but there are so many different unique brands of magic: Wiccan, Hermetic, Chaos Magic, and all the practices and rituals can be just as diverse, and there's definitely a long tradition of these styles, but they also seem to be pretty flexible. And that's the part that hurts my brain, that wants black and white answers. You know, if I want to cut a board in half, I use a saw, you know, but yet I can't just conjure up, I can't just make up in my mind what I determine a saw to be. It is this thing. But magic, it seems to be way more malleable. Does that make sense?
Yeah, your saw metaphor is a good one, because think about it this way. There's a lot of different kinds of saws, right? You could be using that old hand saw. You could be using a jigsaw. You could be using a power saw. I mean, think of those as the different branches of magic. There's that basic kind of function that's going on. And in magic, there's really a few basic operations that everybody does. There's banishing and invocation and evocation, and not really a whole lot more. Most of the other things that the divisions that we make are how we go about doing those different functions. So if you think of invocation, which is drawing qualities into you and bringing the essence of deities and entities and so on into you, you find that over a whole range of different magic. So think of that as the saw, and the different kinds of magic are the different brands of and different types of saws that you can use. And for some things, certainly a jigsaw is more appropriate if you have to make those fine little curly cues and details in your wood, or some things that chainsaw is probably more appropriate if you're if your invocation involves chopping down a big tree of qualities or whatever.
Yeah,
maybe I'm stretching the metaphor here a little bit.
No, I think that's great. That does clarify things a little bit to me. You know, I might be walking down this path a little bit already, but are there any common misconceptions or big pet peeves you have about the layman's understanding of what you do that, you know, it's good to clarify early?
Oh, absolutely. Most people in our culture have this this idea of magic that's essentially drawn from the movies. And just like, you know, movie cops are not much like the cop in your neighborhood.
True.
You know, movie secret agents are not really much like real secret agents, and so on. Movie magicians are really not a whole lot like real magicians. And the things that we see in movies, you know, toothy, slathering demons appear and chew your leg off or something like that. I mean, it's fantasy, right? It's not really what magic is all about. Magic is really, it's a self-discipline. It's a way of recreating who you are, your psyche, and in doing so, recreating your world. Yes, there's certainly mystical elements to that, and certainly very unusual things that happen, and we'll talk about that a little bit. But for the most part, it doesn't really have to do with the things that you see in horror movies or, you know, fantasy tales.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the sexiest aspects of magic to me is the idea of communicating with entities or summoning. And after reading Brain Magic, it seems a lot less weird, really. I actually thought the concept of mimetic entities was really eye-opening. I mean, can you give the people a little bit of information on what mimetic entities are?
Sure. Well, mimetics, of course, is the study of how information spreads, right? A meme is to information what a gene is to biological life. It's that smallest unit of information that carries something from one entity, one being, to another. And just as we are composed of, in a sense, the sum total of our genetics, not really, but to a large extent, we're informed by our genetic makeup, our DNA, and so on. Mimetic entities are composed largely of the sum total of the memes that go into them. Now, I don't want people to confuse this with the idea of internet memes, which are those silly images that we pass around on Facebook that, you know, where the cat wants a cheeseburger and blah, blah, blah. but those are memes in the sense that they are a little piece of information that gets spread around, right? Like a virus, right? Mm-hmm. Call these things viral. And that's the commonality. But for the most part, memes can be a lot more important. They can relate to things like schools of knowledge, schools of philosophy, or different kinds of beliefs or religions or things like that. Now, when we put these entities together, all right, the guy who created the concept of mimetics is Richard Dawkins, who's probably most famous right now as our leading new atheist.
Yes.
And it just seems odd to me that somebody who is studying the way that information interacts with minds would be such a heavy denier of entities.
Yeah, there's a little bit of universal humor there.
Yeah, there is. And his idea, you know, they talk about some of the more scientific or straightforward mimeticists talk about mimetic complexes or memeplexes, which are closer to what I would consider a mimetic entity. Now, the idea of entity is actually something that for most of us is kind of wired into our brains, all right? We tend to look at different kinds of things in our environment and we categorize them as entity or non-entity. And an entity, of course, you're going to try to communicate with. There's a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy reference. It's in the movie where, I'm trying to remember the character's name, Ford Prefect, the first time he meets Arthur Dent, he's trying to shake hands with a car, right? Mm-hmm. And almost gets run over because he thinks it's an entity, right? Yeah. He thinks that's the dominant life form. Our brains do this all the time, and we look at things like cartoon characters, right? If you look at an episode of South Park. Now, these are very crudely drawn characters. They're made to look like cutout paper and so on. Yet they maintain enough entityhood that we identify with the characters enough that we can laugh at them. Mm-hmm. Right? You have to be able to understand Eric Cartman as an entity, right? As a sentient being of some sort, even in your imagination. Otherwise, it's not funny.
Right.
It doesn't. He's not a funny character unless he's a character. So we tend to do that with a lot of different things around us. And some of it's appropriate. Some of it's not. I'm sure quite a few people listening right now have done things like name their automobile or curse at their computer or things like that. Right. There's always this this great scene in the movies where the hero is being pursued by the enemy and they're trying to start their car and they stick the key in and the car doesn't start. They go, come on already. Not now. Don't do this to me now. Right? Who the hell are they talking to?
Right.
Right. They're talking to the car as an entity. And we tend to do that a lot. We tend to relate to things in our environment as entities a little bit more than we're often aware of consciously. Mm-hmm. When we do this with, say, forces of nature or, you know, elements of our consciousness and so on, and we start to give them characteristics of that. Well, this is how back in the day we originated the concepts of deities and, you know, some of the earliest gods and goddesses were stand-ins for forces of nature and so on. Mm-hmm. Now, are they really entities? Do they have sentience that's separate from us? Who knows?
Right.
Our minds don't really function on a large enough level maybe to really understand them, but we can communicate with them in that way and learn things from them. Let's say we accept Hermes as an entity, mm-hmm. right? Hermes being the god of science and language. Does that mean that, you know, this guy with a, you know, a winged helmet is going to suddenly appear in your room and, you know, say, how you doing? And, you know, probably not. However, in the course of a ritual invoking or evoking Hermes, you may actually gain some information concerning language or science or whatever and communicate in that way. Mm-hmm. Some people's imaginations are more thorough than others, and maybe they will see entities as, in their mind's eye, as humanoid figures and so on. And that's very cool when they do. Mm-hmm. For many of us, though, the answers come more in terms of synchronicities or thoughts that arise in our mind and so on.
Yeah, I thought the whole thing was pretty fascinating because, you know, in terms of fictitious characters as archetypes that actually influence our regular reality, I mean, that does happen. As odd as it sounds, you know, you might think, the example I've heard you use in the past is Sherlock Holmes, like obviously not a real person, just a fictional character. But the way that he was written as a detective has influenced the way detectives do their work. And I do think that's pretty fascinating as and that almost makes it real. You know, is it real or not? Well, it has real world influence. So what difference does it make?
Right. It's real on a certain level. It's real on the level of a mimetic entity, but Sherlock Holmes isn't necessarily real in terms of, like, your neighbor is real.
Right.
Right. We do see some of these, some of these entities, things like Jehovah, right, or Allah, who have, you know, they're imaginary, so-called imaginary entities, yet they've changed the world. You know, millions of people have died in the service of some of these entities. Civilizations have been built and civilizations have fallen based on belief and the interaction with some of these entities. They're major forces in human history.
Yeah, that's absolutely a great point. And tell us a little bit about Atem from your book Meta Magic. It sounds like a great experiment in mimetic entities, from what I understand.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. It's an experiment in willfully breaking down the elements of what constitutes a mimetic entity and being able to learning how to be able to create one intentionally. Now, people have done this over the years, certainly with fictional characters and so on. Yet there seems to be a kind of hit or miss quality in that, right? What is it that made Sherlock Holmes a popular character that we've passed down from, you know, through several generations now, whereas, you know, other characters we've long forgotten? So I was sort of kind of studying the elements of that and attempting to codify it a little bit. And in doing so, I needed an entity to practice with. And so Atem was that entity. And I call Atem a self-created entity because the whole process was really developing the entity enough that I could contact the entity and get information from the entity about how it would manifest and so on, and develop it that way. And ultimately, the book came out of that process. And the book itself is a kind of thorough exploration, an experiential exploration of this particular entity that can be passed along from person to person in a mimetic way. Books are inherently mimetic in that we can have the information in that book and hand it to another person and let them get that information and understand it and then verbally or physically pass it along to somebody else. And it's interesting, some of the responses I've got from it. I mean, I get letters from people who read the book about, you know, the appearances of Atem in their life and so on, some of which are pretty wild.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me, and it actually seems like a great way for me to understand mimetic entities. And it's like, it seems just kind of weird. I mean, obviously you'd have to be very skillful and you've been practicing this stuff for a long time, but is it kind of like mentally creating an archetype with a personality in the same way that like a screenwriter would create a character or an author would create a character?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I write these nonfiction books and they sell better than my fiction. but ultimately I consider myself a fiction writer. It's what if I had my druthers about what I was sitting here in my office, doing from day to day, it would be writing fiction. And yes, it is absolutely a very comparable process, to creating characters, and so on. And I mean, in fiction, you know, like the Sherlock Holmes character, I mean, some of our most beloved characters in our culture are fictional ones. I mean, they're ones that came out of comic books and novels, things that represent American culture in ways that nothing else does, like characters out of Mark Twain books or things that represent, you know, if you think about characters that represent Victorian culture or something, you think of Dickens and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So very often we do, some of these characters do actually embody a spirit of a time or an archetype or something like that in ways that we probably couldn't do otherwise. And I think it is kind of an innate way that our mind has adapted to a kind of information rich and evolving environment.
Yeah, man. In a big way, this kind of clarifies an issue that's come up for me before. I was just having a conversation with a friend of mine talking about secret societies performing a specific ritual to summon Cthulhu, which didn't make sense to me because Cthulhu, from my understanding, was just a work of fiction written by Lovecraft. But I guess with this new understanding, it is possible to conjure some type of fictional entity if there's enough of a cohesive understanding of what that archetype is?
Sure, and absolutely. There's plenty of people working with the Lovecraft mythos. On one of my websites, I actually have a really cool piece by Don Webb called the fictive mythology, which is essentially about the Lovecraftian mythos and how magicians are using it. And that's been going on for quite a while. Lovecraft, actually, when I was in college, I wrote a paper on how Lovecraft had incorporated some of the magical writings of the day into his work. And, you know, he was writing horror fiction, so he would always show you the scary side of all of these entities, but they all have their counterparts in classical mythology. This was so long ago, I don't have this in front of me, but some of these, like Shub-Niggurath, the goat with 1,000 young, is certainly a version of the god Pan, you know, but he's showing you the scary side, the side where people would freak out about it, but because he was writing horror fiction and so on. Whether he was really afraid of these things or not is another story. Who knows?
Yeah.
He seems to have, from his personal writings, he seems to have had a sense of humor about it. But in a sense, think about what Lovecraft actually did in writing about these characters and giving these kinds of descriptions. He created some mimetic entities that we've been passing along and that have changed our culture in some interesting, if slightly creepy ways.
Yeah, that's true. So, okay, now this is kind of a stupid question, and you've got to be prepared for stupid questions when you're talking to me. But
okay.
How far does this go? Because with enough focus and skill, could one evoke or summon or manifest a character like Neo from The Matrix or Ron Burgundy from Anchorman or any mimetic entity? Or like, how far does this go?
Well, sure, you could. And certainly the writers and creators of those movies did that, right? But, you know, you could certainly invoke the qualities of Ron Burgundy if you wanted to be like that character, right? You could, in terms of evoking them, you could certainly place them in external positions and carry on an internal or imaginary conversation with them that would enlighten you into some aspects of your life or their life, something like that. Whether you would suddenly make, an entity that looked like Ron Burgundy suddenly appear in your room in a physical form, color me skeptical, but you could certainly work with them as characters in a magical context and as archetypes that would certainly influence your life that you could learn from and so on.
That makes sense. So, like, I guess, you know, people talk about communicating with their higher self or with the universe, which I think are kind of terms for the same thing. It almost seems like if you were to have that internal dialogue with the archetype of Ron Burgundy, it's kind of just a facade for doing that, for communicating with the higher self. Is that kind of accurate? Like, it's kind of just the vessel in which the universe will speak to you, if that's the one you put up there.
To some extent, I think how we slice and dice our understanding of the universe is probably the crucial point here. It's what makes one of these entities is actually how we delineate it, right? Hermes is the god of science and language and so on because we've decided that he is, right? Mm-hmm. Because we say we put a circle around all of these things that are science and language and say, well, this is Hermes, and everything outside the circle is not, right? So when we're talking about the idea of like the higher self and so on, you have some interesting cultural ways to understand that. In Hinduism, for instance, you have, there's different levels of that, right? There's the human one, then there's Atman, mm-hmm. or Atma, which is your higher self, but it's your personal level of it. It's the things in the higher level of the universe that relate specifically to you. Right. And then there's Brahma or Brahman, which is the greater creator god and the greater sense of everything all together, maybe well beyond the personal. So we do have those. And in magic tradition, we have things like the holy guardian angel, which is probably more of your your personal connection to that infinite thing, and then you have various aspects of the universe or God as a sum total, if you'd like, you know, and also other and intermediate things, Gaia, the sum total of life on planet Earth, or the psychosphere, the noosphere, which is the sum total of human consciousness and interaction, so on. So certainly different levels of that you can relate to. And when you're doing your ritual, you sort of decide, you delineate what that is that it is that you're going to be specifically relating to. But yes, all of these things are ultimately fronts for your unconscious mind and the universe as a whole, that unconscious part of the universe that we don't necessarily, that our brains tend to filter out because it's often just too much information to deal with on a moment-to-moment basis.
That makes sense. So, all right, man, when I've asked magic practitioners in the past, sometimes they don't really like to talk about personal experiences, but can you give us any examples of evocation experiences you've had with entities that have been the most confirming or most impactful to you?
Okay, I'm one of these magicians that often avoids talking about my personal experiences. And the main reason is that I don't really want to prejudice people about what their experiences are going to be. Everybody's, when you do one of these evocation rituals or an invocation ritual, everybody has just very uniquely different experiences. And
right.
People read Aleister Crowley's descriptions of it or Israel Regardi's descriptions of it, and they expect theirs to be like that. They go, well, mine didn't do it. The figure didn't form in the smoke like it did for Crowley and blah, blah, blah. And you know, well, you're not Crowley, and you have different ways that it's going to manifest for you. Let's see. I'll give you an example, though. One that I... actually, I described this in Brain Magic, and it just sort of shows how the dichotomy between your conscious understanding and the more universal understanding. Some years ago, my wife and I, we bought a piece of property here in upstate New York, and has lots of many acres of woods and, you know, kind of deep forest. It's an oak and pine forest here. And it had some old buildings on it that we were going to renovate. Now, a number of odd things happened. The first one, before we had just bought the property, and the builders were just starting to go to work renovating one of the business. I went to an event that I was speaking at. I'd speak at a lot of pagan and magical conferences. And there was a workshop there on psychometry. And psychometry is the art of you take an object and you hold it in your hand and you get psychic impressions from it. And I'm not really a practitioner of that, but I wanted to witness it in action. And so I went and I took the keys from the new property, from one of these beat buildings that was on the property. And the first person I handed it to took it and said, I hear this sound that goes, fuck, shit, fuck, shit. And I was like, oh, hell, wow. That's the builder. That's the guy who's working right now. That's what he does. Right? I was like, that was pretty prescient. Mm-hmm. And the next person who took the keys said, the trees want you to thin the forest. I was like, first of all, how he knew that there were trees, that this is a forest and so on, was pretty cool. Right? And yeah. But second of all, you know, my thought was like, that sounds like a little more work than I want to do. I don't have any reason to you know, I don't want to kill trees and I don't, you know, trim the forest. So some years passed, about 2 years passed. We got the building finished here. We moved in and we did an evocation ritual to, you know, consecrate the building, you know, get things rolling here. And, yeah. And we were looking for an entity that would help us with prosperity and making this a viable business place and everything. And so I got this entity that appeared as a big tree, and the words of advice it said to me was, prosperity grows like a tree. I was like, well, that sounds very lovely and very nice. How useful that is, I don't know. another couple of years later, money was getting a little thin. We were dealing with some medical issues and things like that. Money was getting thin. the car broke down. I took the car to the mechanic, who's a friend of mine, and the mechanic said, well, where are you living now? And I you know, told him about the property we had bought, and he said, oh, I checked into the timber history of your property, and you've got about $40,000 worth of timber ready to be cut on that property.
Whoa.
And so, of course, my mind flashed back on, well, the forest wants you to trim the trees, and prosperity grows like a tree, and so on. I'm like, well, all right, I'm a little slow, you know. I may consider myself a magician, but I don't, you know, I try to suspend judgment. Maybe I'm doing it a little bit too long. So the short version of the end of that story is that we did do a little, we called the timber guy and he came, and we didn't do $40,000 worth of cutting, but we did enough to cover some of our immediate needs and pay our taxes and so on for that year.
Yeah.
You know, just sort of an example of how your conscious mind may have a little dichotomy for what's going on unconsciously and universally and so on.
Yeah, that's an excellent example, and I definitely understand the reluctance to talk about those personal experiences, so I appreciate that. It's, for me, it's because I want to know, you know, what it can do. Again, to go back to the saw or the hammer, I know what a saw or a hammer can do. I want to know what an evocation ritual can do. You know, I want to know what it's like, so I appreciate that. That's pretty awesome. But, you know, rather than talk about personal experiences, let's talk about a more objective, like, lesson, because I know brain magic is full of exercises and lessons in magic ritual, and I highly recommend digging into it for anyone interested. But I was hoping you could walk people through just one of these rituals to give them an idea of how it works. Particularly, the one that I found pretty interesting is the simple evocation of basic positive resource entities. I don't know if you remember specifically that lesson, but could you walk people through a little bit of that exercise?
Sure, absolutely. A simple evocation is basically a method of taking a particular feeling that you have and relating to it as an entity. And it is one of these things that we do quite naturally all the time, or most of us do. Some people are wired a little differently than others. But for most people, this is a really kind of simple and easy thing to do. So people who are listening now, unless you're driving a car or otherwise operating heavy machinery, you can just relax where you're sitting and close your eyes, take a nice deep breath, and just begin to notice how your body feels as you breathe and relax a little bit. Notice how when you breathe deeply, certain muscles start to relax. And as you do that, think about some time, either recently or in the past, when you just felt really, really good. You had a wonderful feeling. Okay, and since this is audio only, you don't have to share this with anybody. It could be anything. Right. So just identify what that wonderful feeling is. For most of us, when I ask a question like that, say identify a wonderful feeling, it takes a moment to actually sort of run through a little range of things in your mind of which one is the most wonderful and so on. So probably if you're listening and you're following along, you've probably had a moment of that experience. And hopefully at this point, you've settled on a particularly wonderful experience that you'd like to work with. And think about where in your body you have the feelings that let you know it's wonderful, right? There's certain things that you feel viscerally and physically that allow you to make that evaluation. It says, this is a good feeling, right? For most people, these feelings happen along the center line of your body, but it could happen, you know, one side or the other. Everybody's a little bit different. And so recall this experience. Remember what you saw at that time. And remember what you heard at that time. And remember what you felt at that time. And that starts with the physical position of your body, anything that was touching you or you were touching. And then, of course, those internal feelings that let you know that it's a good feeling. Okay, and notice where in your body you have those feelings. And ask yourself, if this feeling or had a color or colors, what would it be? Right, so everywhere in your body that you have that good feeling, apply that color or colors. And keep breathing and relaxing as you do this. And notice now that kind of 3D color map in your body. And when you're ready, just take a nice deep breath and take that colored map out of your body using your imagination, or you could use your hands if it helps, and place it in front of you and flip it around to face you. Okay. And breathe deeply, and each time you exhale, give that breath and energy and attention into that colored shape. And notice what happens as you continue to give it breath and attention. And then in your mind, you can open the lines of communication. And the first thing to do is to ask this entity what it would like to be called, what identifies it. Okay, and maybe it's a name, maybe it's a word, maybe it's a sound or a feeling or a symbol. Okay, but something so that if you wanted to call this entity back at some point, you could. Okay. And whatever the response was, you can ask this entity what it has to teach you. What's it there for? Maybe it's there to teach you how to feel wonderful more often. Or maybe there's some other lesson. And you can also ask this entity if there's something that it would like to accomplish now away from your body. Maybe there's something it can go off in the world and do for you without your conscious knowledge. If the answer to that is yes, then get a time from it that it will do this and come back to you. 5 minutes, an hour, a week, a month, whatever it is. And if it said no, then thank it and flip it back around and bring it into your body. If it said yes and you have an agreement of a time, then make note of that time and send it off to go do what it wants to do. And when you're ready, either way, if the entity has come back into you or if it's going off in the world somewhere, just take a nice deep breath, bring your attention back into your body, and open your eyes and bring your awareness back to your present situation.
Wow, man. Thanks for doing that. That's pretty cool. Boom.
Yeah, it's a pretty simple thing. I've done this with like pretty large groups of people at times, and most people, I think we have kind of a 95% rate of people actually contacting entities and so on. Of course, they're not, these are small personal entities. They may or may not be mimetic, they whatever, but usually everybody gets at least some experience of, wow, that's an entity, and maybe some interesting information.
Yeah, I think that's super cool. And thousands of beings just came into existence right there. You know, one thing that I'm curious about is increasing accuracy. Like, let's say, I guess, what if the things you set in place right there or during one of these rituals don't tend to manifest? Like, that to me makes the whole practice seem invalid. That's happened to me before in the past. And of course, I'm sure it's just a matter of fine tuning, but how can we increase our accuracy if we run into one of those types of roadblocks?
Well, yeah, again, it's very often a fine tuning kind of thing. Very often it's about the way people have framed what the intent is. I get this kind of stuff as a hypnosis practitioner as well, where people will, they come in with negative intents, all right? And as a hypnosis practitioner, I get that even more so than as a magic practitioner, where people come in and say, well, I want to stop smoking, or I don't want to be fat, right? And so, you know, well and good, but what is it that you want to be, right? It leaves a void. And generally when intents are phrased that way, they often don't become manifest because there isn't a coherent goal to go towards, really, right? There's something you're going away from, but not something that you're really, that you've defined well enough to go towards, right? So I'll get people to at least reframe some of those, you know, well, I want to be healthy, or I want to, you know, I want to be able to breathe clearly, or I want to, you know, be fit enough to have the stamina to win a bicycle race, or whatever it is that they want to do, ultimately. Mm-hmm. So that's often one of the things that people need to tweak, kind of a simple thing. But there's other ones as well. There's if people are distracted while they're doing the ritual, maybe they need to increase their focus a little bit, and so on. So there's a lot of stuff. These are good reasons for actually doing some of this in the company of an experienced practitioner or a teacher or something who can kind of watch what you do and give you some feedback, like in any other field that you're going to learn.
Yeah. Right on. All right, man. Now I tend to think conspiratorially, you know, I tend to think a powerful elite who have a better understanding of how the world works, put a lot of energy into keeping the masses away from anything that empowers the individual. And modern society seems so tailored to looking externally for happiness or fulfillment. I mean, even you mentioned the language we use isn't super conducive for communication with the universe. Even down to that, I wonder if these things aren't, you know, if the way that the world is today isn't put that way for a reason, to keep us from understanding our true potential. Or, I mean, what do you think? Is it, do you just chalk it up to coincidence, or do you think it's more design?
I think it's some of both. I think that there are a lot of forces that really don't want you to access your internal information, that don't want you to really find a lot of the solutions for your own life, because they have personal and greedy and other outcomes for them, for themselves. And, you know, in our culture, we have this, you know, like a consumer culture and so on, where we're told these basic truths about our reality that are really absolutely useless. The whole, when I was growing up, the whole American dream thing, where you, a house and two cars and you know, whatever it was. And basically these were memes that were given to us by the house and the car companies, right?
Yeah.
These corporate entities that, you know, and this is an interesting term, right? We think of corporate entities, right?
Yeah.
That want to see us in servitude to them, and to a certain extent. They want us to be in debt to them. They want
absolutely
our money to go to them, and so on. So, there's certainly a conspiracy that way. There's that dovetails pretty well with the government conspiracy, as far as I'm concerned, that a lot of our government, particularly right now in our country, is in service to the big money of these major corporations.
Right.
I don't necessarily think that there's these conspiracies of, you know, I don't know, the Illuminati or things like that. They were maybe active at one time. And what their agenda was, I don't know. If at some point they did exist in ways that carried on, they were probably there because they were co-opted by a government or a corporation or something like that. Mm-hmm. And if any of them do exist today, they're probably there's money involved. Yeah. Let's just say.
I think that's a great analysis, because when I think of corporate entities. Well, you know, I had a conversation with Lone Milo Duquette, and I mentioned, you know, a lot of times I'll see a guy on the beach reading tarot cards, and I'm like, what does that guy have to offer me? His life looks like one step away from being homeless. And so it's easy to project that onto people who are in the magic realm, because a lot of times you'll see that, you know, you see palm readers that don't seem to be all that successful. If they had some access to information that you don't have, you think they would they'd be something to aspire to. But yeah, in terms of the corporate entities, you know, it just seems like magic is being used,
right,
in some of those cases, and it's used in secret, and a lot of areas where it's suggested to be used, those people are making a lot of money, having a lot of success. So it's easy to look at the guy on the boardwalk and say, oh, magic's all bullshit. But maybe look at some of the other things where it's not so overt that a lot of those tools seem to be working.
Right. Well, one thing you have to remember about magic is that it's not a, it's not a regulated and structured field like physics or medicine or something like that is in our society. And we don't really have, there's no protocol who gets called a magician. And so you do have, right, you have a lot of phonies and frauds and people who are doing bizarre and unsafe things and people who are doing pretty ineffective and ego-based things and so on. And so we do have, along with that, I often get the thing, it's like, well, if you're, if you're so good at magic, how come you're not a millionaire? Right. And, and well, I say, well, at times I actually have been a millionaire. I've had money. I've been poor. Now I'm somewhere in between. My goals usually aren't necessarily about money. There's usually enough money involved for me to, my goals are usually about doing what I want to do,
right,
in my life.
Freedom, which entails money sometimes.
Yes, right, which certainly entails money. I certainly have to be able to pay my electric bill and my phone bill and my internet bill and things like that if, you know, I want to do some of the things I want to do. However, having a huge bank account isn't always the way to do that, and it's often a distraction. And I learned that in the past when I was doing more business-oriented things. And I worked in the corporate world as a writer for a number of years, writing copy for pharmaceutical companies and financial institutions and things like that. And ultimately, you know, it struck me that, yeah, I'm making a nice living. I'm doing okay doing this, but I'm actually spending the time in my life that doing things that aren't necessarily what I want to be doing at that time.
Yeah.
And then I thought back on, you know, some of the best times of my life when I was absolutely flat, broke, piss poor, whatever. And yet I was having a really great time doing things like writing books and stuff like that. So hopefully I find that, you know, my life is about finding that happy medium where I have enough money to do the things I want to do, but I'm not obsessed with spending all my time getting money.
Mm-hmm.
Which in our culture, that's what we're often told is the important thing to do, right?
Yeah.
That's how you spend your money. Spend your time. I'm sorry. Time is money.
Right.
Right? You spend your time getting money.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not doing that, well, you're somehow a failure or something like that. And, you know, maybe this guy sitting out on the boardwalk with his tarot cards is, maybe he's really happy, right?
True.
And I met people years ago who were doing things like that. And I remember this one guy who was a small time fungus salesman in the college town where I was going to school years ago, and seemed like this total burned out hippie guy. But once we started talking to him, turned out he was this fantastically successful stockbroker who had just had this epiphany, which related to his mushroom, his fungus, enjoyment.
It'll do that to you.
He had had this epiphany with that the stockbroking was ultimately an evil thing. And he moved out into the woods and started doing what he was doing. And he was one of the happiest people I ever met. And it was really kind of a surprise that he was a big time corporate stockbroker for, you know, this one of these top companies. And we're like, whoa, really? You?
Yeah.
You know, so you never know. And everybody has different goals and works by different standards. And it's interesting. At one point, I remember I posted something on my Facebook page about, how come all these magicians I see are poor? I'm like, well, I know plenty of them that are actually quite wealthy. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily identify themselves publicly as magicians.
Right.
Right. They're businessmen or rock stars or, you know, whatever. And there's actually some very, well-known people who practiced magic that they at least credit somewhat who are just, incredibly famous people like David Bowie or Jimmy Page or, things like people like that who were very involved in magic at one time. I don't know if they still are, but certainly while they were involved in magic, they moved very quickly to the top of whatever their field was. And, I know a biochemist who's one of the top biochemists around. I know a guy who's a bank executive, and so on. So they're all right there. But we don't necessarily see them because they don't necessarily hang out a sign that says, I am a practicing Thelemic magician or I am a chaos magician, because it confuses people,
right.
Particularly in some of these fields.
And that totally makes sense. I mean, there's a lot of judgment out there. I think the thing that Lone Milo Duquette said that rang true was, a wealthy man can choose his appearance, but a poor man can't hide his poverty, which is exactly what you're talking about, But man, this has been a blast, Phil. This is probably hands down my favorite conversation about magic that I've had thus far. It's a really slippery thing for me to talk about sometimes. Yeah. A lot of times it's also so subjective to what a person wants or a person's view. So it's very hard to talk about sometimes, but this has just been great. Before we go, I wanted to grab this Redditor's comment. We have a little subreddit where occasionally people suggest guests, and when they do suggest a guest who gets back to me, I usually post like, hey, they're going to be on the show. And that was the case here. And I asked the person who suggested you to come on the show if they had anything specific that they'd like me to ask. And we kind of touched on some of this, but he wrote, Phil would be an awesome guest. That just made my day. I'd really like to hear him talk freely on his ideas of bridging the unconscious and the conscious mind using evocation and invocation. One or two of his techniques has really helped me with real world psych issues, and I think the listeners would love it. We did a little bit of that, but if you would expand on your ideas for bridging the unconscious and the conscious before we go, that would be awesome.
Okay. To start with, I use the terms unconscious and conscious quite a bit. However, understanding of the brain proceeds, they're getting to be kind of archaic terms. Ultimately, I think what we're talking about when we talk about conscious and unconscious is the difference in our brain between what's known as executive function, which is our conscious ability to direct what our brain does and to make choices and to focus our attention, and the brain's what's called the default mode network, which is essentially our imagination and daydreaming and the brain's ability to process things on a level that is beyond that usual consciously directed executive function. And the brain's default network, this is actually a very recent development in neuroscience that they've discovered this. It's a series of areas in the brain. Now, up until very recently, when they studied brain stuff, it was brain localization of function, where we look into the amygdala, that's about emotion over there, and the hippocampus, that's about short-term memory, and the prefrontal cortex, that's about the higher functions, and so on. However, what they're finding now is that the brain tends to hook itself up in these different areas, tend to hook themselves up into different patterns and to different, it's kind of like modular. So when these different areas of the brain hook up in different configurations, you have different networks running in the brain. And possibly the most important discovery in recent years was the default mode network, which is what happens when you stop consciously directing your brain, when you just let it relax and it goes off and it starts thinking things and daydreaming and dreaming and making images and feelings and so on. Magic is essentially the conscious use. Carl Jung gave us the definition. Magic is the conscious use of active imagination. So in a sense, magic is the conscious use of this default mode network. It's being able to flip it on in ways that give us access to this wider range of information that's usually outside of our conscious mind. The default mode network, it does some very interesting things. One of the more interesting things that it does is it's called transderivational search. All right. So a good example of transderivational search, like when I said in the exercise earlier, think of a very pleasant experience you had. The brain has to, the transderivational search is when the brain pops up 15 of these different experiences and you have to sort through and pick the one that's the most. Okay. The brain does this constantly with a lot of different kinds of information. If I say the word chair or apple or something like that, immediately your mind, sometimes too fast to consciously apprehend, but it has to come up with a range of chairs, and then you pick the one that's appropriate for the context, right? Or a range of apples, and you pick the one that's appropriate for the context. So your brain is constantly going through this, and in a sense, it is delineating your reality. Right. So when I say, you know, it's most comfortable to sit in a chair, right? Your brain is going to go through it, and it's not going to pick necessarily the uncomfortable chair. It's going to pick one that kind of makes that statement a little bit more true. It's going to pick a comfortable one. So in a sense, you're at that moment, at any rate, you're defining chairs in a particular context. And that's the way at that time in your life, at that particular moment, the reality of chairs is for you. If that makes sense.
So
the default network is constantly helping us to define and delineate what our present reality may be. And there's also a, interestingly enough with this, well, first of all, because it does that, every bit of perception that comes through the default network comes with this big range of associations and possibilities and outcomes and so on. It processes, it's like it's playing a game of chess. It processes everything 10, 15, 100 moves in advance. But it only lets through that conscious, to the conscious part of your brain, that little bit that the conscious part of your brain can understand at any given moment. So every time this default mode network switches on, which is, again, if you're listening to me speaking, if you're meditating, right, when that those distractions start popping up and things like that, in effect, you are at that moment using your unconscious mind to define reality. The more you access that and the more you are able to guide it in particular ways, and that's where magic comes in, where we set up these ritual frames that help to guide the way that your default network makes judgments and picks out the particular delineations of different things, by using this ritual context. I know this is a fairly complex idea, but ultimately, at almost every moment, you're engaging in sort of a magical act of defining what your reality is. And by accessing that process, consider that your unconscious mind, you get to choose a little bit more of what it is. So in a sense, by learning this process, and meditation is a great help because it helps you to understand how your hypnosis as well, that how your default network and your executive functions switch back and forth. There are some instances where they can, normally they're mutually exclusive, right? If your executive function switches on, the default network automatically switches off. And there are problems with that. Schizophrenia seems to be a problem where the default network switches off prematurely and whatever was in the fantasy suddenly gets delineated as reality.
Oh, that makes sense.
Okay. And However, we do get to my default network just switched on and I sort of lost my thread there. when you start talking about trance activity, things that are very transient, sort of does induce it. And I hope people are following along without trancing out too much. But you do get to make some decisions about how that works and how your reality is delineated. And ultimately, if you change that personal level of reality, and you can get information from the default network, from your unconscious mind in that way, and so on. Does it all connect with some greater reality? Does it all connect with the world at large? I think so. I think we have obvious, if not quantum or unconscious connections with everything. Everything seems to affect everything else. You drop a pebble into a pond, the ripples spread out, keep going indefinitely, even when they get too small for you to see with your eye. Mm-hmm. Every action you make does that. Every thought that you think changes you in some way and changes the world around you in some minute or greater way.
Yeah.
So by being able to consciously access this ability of your brain to imagine, to process information on this more intense level or deeper level and so on, you are coming to terms with your unconscious mind and maybe exerting a greater influence on your reality at that point.
Right on.
I hope I answered the question.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it's kind of a complex one.
It is, and I'm glad I read that off. But yeah, a heavy place to end. But I'm still glad that we got there. So Phil, very cool. I love talking to you. Do you want to give the people your website and anything else you got going on before we really call it in?
Sure. Sure. People can find me at www.metamagic.com. That's metamagic.com. And also at hawkridgeproductions.com. There's a lot of, at hawkridgeproductions.com, there's a lot of free articles and things that people can read. And there's also links to my various books and so on. I got another book coming out this summer, a novel called Legendary Blue Smoke. People should watch for. It should be out, I'm guessing, end of July. And we didn't mention my novels at all, but the one that I think that magic fans will enjoy is called The Great Purple Hoo-Ha, which actually incorporates some of the ideas in brain magic and meta magic in a fictional and more entertaining setting that's a little more fun to read, though I hope the nonfiction books are kind of fun to read, too.
Right on. Well, I love brain magic.
Thank you. Yeah, so there they can go on to Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and you just put my name in, and you'll see all my books.
Awesome, man. Well, thanks again. You know, it's Friday the 13th. This is my first day with this new black cat that I adopted. So I'm well on my way. I'm trying to catch up to you, man. But I do appreciate it. Yeah. Take care of yourself out there.
Okay, take care. I enjoyed it.
Do you believe in magic in a young girl's heart?